Well, hello and welcome back to Archaeology News Weekly. I am, as ever, your host, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website, and all the stories have been collected from various sources. So to view details on each story, including the source, see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. We start with Stone Pages' own report on a Neolithic necropolis under threat in Sardinia. Then we open up an ancient Swiss door, before delving into a Bronze Age tomb found in Poland, and the restoration of 31 prehistoric sites on Dartmoor in southwest England. The remains of the youngest Neanderthal child ever found is uncovered in Belgium, and remarkably, the diet of early humans may have included ground flour. Bronze and Iron Age remains are found in Wales, while we explore the hidden landscape of the Swedish Stone Age. The latest discovery in Peru, and the ancient geoglyphs, or just agriculture. The White Horse of Uffington, or perhaps we should be saying the White Dog. We'll be looking at that later. British burial law is also threatening to the future of archaeological research. And then there are investigations into the carved stones of West Yorkshire. Finally, with our friends in Shetland, there's a prehistoric house being discovered. Our first story, of course, is that one is near and dear to our hearts, and you'll be able to read the full illustrated article on the new Past Horizons website. That was www.pasthorizons.com. Although rock-cut tombs are relatively common in Sardinia, the Tomba del Scacchiere has an altogether unique carved and painted rock art heritage that's now at the centre of a controversy. This monument, dating to the Ozeri period between 3000 and 1500 BCE, revealed by chance a wealth of painted and engraved art that graced its walls and ceiling. Following excavation, the tomb was sealed by Italian archaeologists and concealed from the public and researchers alike. Thanks to the unofficial photographs taken by a neighbouring landowner, you'll actually also be able to see them on, of course, the Past Horizons site in a previous article. The importance of the site was brought to light based on a recent visit by an international team of specialists, including rock art expert George Nash from the Department of Archaeology and Anthropology, University of Bristol, and conservation archaeologist Jane Pilkington, where they were clear that certain basic protocols enshrined in the Valletta Convention had been violated by the Italian authorities. Furthermore, nothing had been considered for the long-term conservation of this and nearby Neolithic ritual burial sites, including tomb number 3, the so-called Tomb of the Spirals, at the necropolis of Sapalla Larga, which was in an advanced state of deterioration when it was visited. In addition to infilling the entrance of the main tomb, the Italian heritage authorities had also covered most of the outside surface with a concrete skin, further destroying potential external context. According to officials, this act of, shall we say, conservation was undertaken in order to protect the tomb from looters and vandalism. Observations made by the team at the nearby Sapalla Larga No. 3 site noted that the chamber itself was flooded with stagnant water, which was destroying the interior. In order to address these and other issues, the experts urged the Italian heritage authorities to consider the commissioning of a conservation management plan, outlining monument context in relation to others in the area, collating all the available archaeological information, and addressing the conservation issues, perhaps even considering the value of these sites for cultural heritage tourism. Well, as I said, a full article, including some quite amazing and disturbing photographs, is available on Past Horizons. That's www.pasthorizons.com. Archaeologists in Zurich have found a rare example of an ancient wooden door. Chief archaeologist Niels Blecher announced that, according to tree ring dating, the door could date back to 3063 BCE. He explained that the door, made of poplar wood, is solid and elegant, and is very remarkable because of the way that the planks were held together. He also noted its well-preserved hinges. The door belonged to a lakeside stilt house that probably formed part of a settlement. Archaeologists found evidence of 5 Neolithic villages that existed between 3700 and 2500 BCE. Finding the door of such a house is rare. German archaeologist Helmut Schlichterhell said that while 200 stilt houses had been found in southern Germany, no doors had survived. And while some people may say, well, it's only a door, this is really a great find because it helps us to understand how people built their houses and what technology they had. Few other ancient doors have been found. There was one at nearby Pifkon, similar to the Zurich example, and a solid door made from one piece of wood was found in the 19th century. And this door, however, will be put on display after it's been excavated and chemically treated to prevent it rotting. And in Poland, Polish archaeologists recently reported the discovery of a tomb of whom they believed to be a young prince dating back to 6000 BCE near the A4 motorway. Scientists who were carrying out excavations on the route of the future A4 motorway hoped to find traces of Neolithic settlement. But this discovery exceeded their expectations. Initially, they found a copper axe, which may have dated back to the Bronze Age. Later, they found other archaeological objects, such as copper ornaments, two earrings and a necklace, plus five vessels, an amphora and four cups. There was also arrowheads and dozens of flint tools and animal bones, which may have been a funerary gift. Inside the grave, the scientists also found fragments of a 6,000-year-old male skeleton laid on his right side. The position is typical for the corded ware or single grave culture, which flourished through the Copper Age and culminated in the Early Bronze Age around 4000 BCE. The ornaments and tools from the tomb, along with the other archaeological discoveries, will be on display in the Regional Museum next year. Well, there's been a plethora of news items here in the UK. Let's get going on them. As a result of a five-year project, a great deal of prehistoric sites on Dartmoor have been restored. 49 of the summit cairns, which are ancient burial mounds dating back to 2000 BCE, were surveyed and 31 of them needed restoration. We're happy to report that now they have been taken off the English Heritage at Risk Register. That is indeed good news. DNPA, English Heritage, and volunteers from the Dartmoor Preservation Association are doing the restoration work. Michael Nendick from the Park Authority said the work was vital, as Dartmoor is one of the most important places in Western Europe when it comes to prehistoric sites. During the survey work, the team learned more about how the cairns were actually constructed, and it's clear they're not just random collection of stones. They're very complex, multi-phase sites, which were done over a large period of time and were obviously very carefully planned as well. Previously unknown features within and around the cairns have also been identified, such as the curbstones, ring banks and smaller satellite cairns. Beyond this project, helping to protect threatened archaeological sites on the moor, it's created a pool of highly skilled surveyors as well, drawn from the local community, who, through their work, are helping to increase our understanding of the past. One of the biggest risks to cairns is simply disturbance from people visiting the sites. People will just pick up stones, not realizing they're actually part of an ancient monument. The project has just come to an end, but plans are underway to restore more of Dartmoor's 3,000 Bronze Age cairns. Luckily, these ancient monuments have the highest level of protection available in England. Andy Crabb, archaeologist at Dartmoor National Park Authority, explained that they started with the cairns at the honeypot sites where they have been damaged. They are on hold until next year when the team will go back and assess more of the most exposed cairns. And now from cairns in Dartmoor to burial mounds in Wales. Bronze and Iron Age remains have been unearthed at the site of a new bypass in Powys in Wales. The Clwyd Powys Archaeological Trust, or CPAT, said a number of interesting finds had been made. Among the earliest sites found is a ring ditch representing an early prehistoric burial mound. CPAT said that it would analyse the findings. They also found crop marks in the area, which they claim denote other burial sites. Archaeologists uncovered possible Mesolithic activity, Neolithic and Bronze Age burial monuments, Iron Age burials and ring ditches, with a central grave pit representing an early prehistoric burial mound. They also uncovered some metalworking. It said that up to a dozen or so Neolithic and Bronze Age burial mounds were now known in the area of the Four Crosses. And now the big debate. Is it a horse or is it a dog? It's one of Britain's most loved ancient hill figures, leaping across the downland. But vets are now being urged to question whether the white horse of Uffington was intended to be a horse after all. Retired veterinarian Olaf Swarbrick, challenging the traditional description of the Oxfordshire landmark, asked whether the figure might indeed be a dog, such as a greyhound or a wolfhound. In a letter to the Veterinary Record, the former cattle and poultry specialist put forth a canine origin for the 110-metre-long animal, which was carefully dug into the downland. He invites alternative theories as well. He noted that when looking at it again, it seems that it is not a horse at all, stating that the tail and the head are wrong for a horse and more suggestive of a dog. He feels it appears more like a large hound at full stretch. He had thought it might be a greyhound, but an anthropologist suggests it could be a wolfhound, which, assuming it's not a horse, makes more sense to him. The horse, if it is indeed one, are you getting confused here? I certainly am, is approximately 3,000 years old and dates to approximately 1250 to 850 BCE. It was previously believed to be Anglo-Saxon in origin, but Swarbrick, in saying it's not a horse, knows he will perhaps infuriate some archaeologists. He did add that other horse hill figures in Britain were quite clearly horses, even if they are more recently constructed than the Uffington one. But Keith Blackshall, the National Trust warden for the area, was not convinced, stating that coins from roughly the same period show a similar stylized horse and chariot. Horses were enormously important, signifying power and mobility. There had been claims that it might be St. George's White Charger, he said, but the figure long predated this era. The dog suggestion was a new one to him, but he's quite unconcerned by the site's equine symbolism being doubted. In a way, that's really what it's all about. The site is what you want it to be. Now, on a bit more of a sombre note, according to experts, the severe restrictions on scientists' freedom to study bones and skulls from ancient graves are putting archaeological research in Britain at risk. The growing dispute concerns controversial legislation introduced by the Ministry of Justice in 2008, which decreed that all human remains discovered during digs in Britain must be reburied within 2 years. This decision means that scientists may have insufficient time to carry out proper studies of any pieces of ancient skeleton that they uncover. As a result of this new legislation, key information about British history will be lost. Archaeologist Mike Pitts of the Stonehenge Riverside Project wonders what would happen if one of his paleontologists found the remains of a million-year-old human. It would be a truly wonderful discovery and would transform our knowledge of our predecessors, but according to the Ministry of Justice ruling, he would have to take that fossil when he had only just begun to study it and put it back into the soil. It's utterly absurd, utterly inappropriate way to use the law to control archaeology, Pitts remarked. I appreciate someone telling us how they really feel. Nice one, Mike. Scientists are already facing the prospect of having to rebury a cache of human bone fragments, the remains of more than 50 individuals excavated in 2008 at a site known as Aubrey Hole 7 as part of the Stonehenge Riverside Project. Team members, including Mike Pitts, had hoped that they would be able to study these fragments to acquire new knowledge about the people who built and used Stonehenge. The preliminary study of the 50,000 bone fragments is expected to run from 2008 until 2015, but as the current issue of British archaeology reveals, they're faced with the prospect of having to rebury the remains when the research has only just begun. They've applied for an extension, but even if they get one, it would only be for 2 more years, then the bones will have to be reburied. 50,000 bones in a few years? They'll certainly miss some key information at that rate. British Ministry of Justice officials decided that the Burial Act of 1857 was the appropriate legislation for controlling archaeological digs at burial sites. They dictated that archaeologists could dig bones and skulls up, but insisted they would have to rebury them within 2 years in an accepted place of burial. A cemetery, for example, where the excavations would need to be screened from the public. The requirement for reburial within 2 years is not the only issue that vexes archaeologists, however. Note the Ministry's requirement that any excavation of human remains must be screened from the public. This has also caused great displeasure, and for good reason as well. Dr. Duncan Sayre of the University of Central Lancashire, who's currently leading an excavation at a Saxon cemetery at Oakington in Cambridgeshire, notes that if you dig up an old burial ground and then screen your dig from the local people, things start to look very suspicious. People tend to think that you're doing something sinister, but this legislation is ironic in that the government has insisted on the public being given access to scientific research and for there to be openness between scientists and the public. But now there seems to be a prevention to allow people to do that. Maybe when we're digging up in burial grounds, we should post a sign explaining to the public that they must be left out and explain to them exactly why. I know myself, actually, on the recent excavations where we have been discovering some quite remarkable burials from the late Iron Age and the Roman period, that it absolutely fascinated the workers on the site. It was the one thing that they really wanted to see. Strangely, they weren't that enamored by Roman ditch cuts or post holes, but when it came to looking really into the face of their own past, that's really what inspired them. Anyway, on a more positive note, a team of consultants has been selected to lead the prehistoric carved rocks project on Rumbold's Moor, the moorland between Ilkley and Caley in West Yorkshire. In addition to written records, this involves photographing the rocks to create 3D images through photogrammetry. Photogrammetry is the practice of determining the geometric properties of an object from photographic images. The output of photogrammetry is typically a drawing or a 3D model of some real-world object or scene. The team's experience in conducting a similar project covering Northumbria and Durham will prove a real asset in establishing a unique record that will provide the basis for future interpretation and management. The project will be launched in Ilkley on Saturday the 6th of November, where there will be an opportunity to learn more about the project and register your interest of being involved. Over the coming months, a series of training sessions covering surveying, recording, and photographic techniques will be organised for community volunteers to learn how best that they can help undertake the work over the next 3 years. The project will also aim to ensure that the skills and knowledge gained during this time will allow the work to continue and develop after the project has come to an end. So if you wish to register interest in either of these projects, please contact Gavin Edwards, who's the community archaeologist, at gavin.edwards, that's an S at the end there, at penineprospects.co.uk. That was gavin.edwards at penineprospects.co.uk. It's a groundbreaking, pardon the pun, opportunity. So if any of our listeners are in this area or planning a vacation there, go ahead, get involved. Interesting find from Scotland now. A previously unknown archaeological site has come to light in Shetland during work on a gas plant. As a result, a team of archaeologists have been excavating a prehistoric house and other associated structures over the past 6 weeks. The site was found by local archaeologist Rick Barton, one of the team of experts working for Orca, an Orkney-based archaeological contractor, followed by archaeologist Amanda Brend during the 6 weeks excavation. The main building discovered at the site is probably 4,000 to 5,000 years old, has walls which include stone boulders, and is between 7 and 8 meters wide. There's a hearth at the centre of it as well, although the site has been badly eroded by hill wash. There are traces of possible floor surfaces, with a lot of worked quartz and charcoal flecking. In addition, the team has discovered some large pieces of pottery. Quartz specialist Torben Ballen has had a preliminary look at some of the quartz and believes it is possible that some of it can be used to help date the site. A few yards to the north, the team discovered a beautifully constructed stone-lined oval pit. There's neatly paved floor in it and many samples have been taken, which will be analysed in the laboratory and might give more of an idea about what this was used for. On the southern side of the house, there are two other structures. The larger may be a chambered cairn, although surprisingly it's built up against the side of a house. It is clearly later than the house itself and may have actually been generated from some of the stones of the house. There were hints of a heel-shaped front and an internal chamber, as well as traces of a built outer edge. Adjacent to this is what Miss Brand described as a trapezoidal feature, a small diamond-shaped feature about 1.8 metres by 1.3. It had very clearly built edges constructed from boulders and the inside was covered with fist-sized pebbles, mainly white. It's possible that this too was for burial or ritual. The team took it apart, but unfortunately there did not seem to be anything inside it or underneath it. Perhaps it was a platform for laying the bodies on while they decomposed, perhaps helped by the birds, before some of the bones were then reburied within the chambered cairn. Sometimes the guessing is half the fun. Meanwhile, the initial results from the two pollen cores, which were taken from the gas plant site in advance of the development, have just become available. The bottom of the peat cores date to 9725 and 9065, plus or minus 35 years BCE. Unfortunately, it's not possible for visitors to see the site as it is within the middle of a development area. The archaeologists will dismantle large parts of the site in their quest to discover how the buildings were constructed, and anything left will then disappear beneath the gas plant. However, the team will be writing up the excavations and are hoping that even more archaeology will emerge in the peat. Right, in Belgium, the lower jaw of the teeth of a Neanderthal child who lived to be 1.5 years old was found in the Spy Cave in Belgium. This is the youngest Neanderthal individual ever discovered in Northwest Europe. The remains of the two adults were previously found at the site. DNA analysis will be conducted to determine if the adult individuals are related to the infant. The mandible was sturdier than that of a modern child of the same age, and its teeth were larger, with a thinner enamel layer. There are also indications that the child was growing quickly. The excavation was led by Isabelle Crevecoeur, who directs the National Centre for Scientific Research, it's easier to say CNRS, in France. The study is to be published in the Journal of Human Evolution. She describes the site where the discovery was made as being at the bottom of a cliff that overhangs the valley, which is probably really advantageous with such a clear view. Belgium has a long-standing Neanderthal history with the highest concentration of Neanderthal remains. The first specimen ever found was in Belgium during the 19th century, and Neanderthal remains from Belgium have also provided the oldest DNA sequence to date. Well, very impressive. The earliest Neanderthal artifacts and remains in the cave date to approximately 38,000 years BCE. It's estimated that the child died 33,000 years ago, so the occupation of the cave lasted at least 1,000 years. Eric Trinkaus, a physical anthropologist from Washington University in St. Louis in the US and a well-known expert on Neanderthals, believes that the conclusions of the study are well-reasoned and reasonable, as there are very few fossils and pathetically small amount of modern human comparative samples. He welcomes this new addition and hopes that it will help scientists get a better handle on the real variations to Neanderthal growth and development. A visitor centre at the Spy Cave will open on June 2011 and is slated to include virtual reconstructions of the adult Neanderthals from the site. Our next story has to do with pita bread. Well, partly. It's long been held that our human ancestors subsisted only on meat. Well, not really actually, but let's continue. Several discoveries made recently in Near East Paleolithic sites have also provided evidence of plant-based foods. Starch grains from cattail, grasses and fern plants have been found on grinding stones dating back to 28,000 years BCE. These stones have been found across Europe in locations ranging from Italy to the Czech Republic. The flour residue gives a hint that the diet of early humans may have included a pita-like bread made from flour and baked on hot stones. The consumption of meat is easier to observe at ancient sites, as the butchering of animals leaves marks on bones that can be observed by the archaeologists. Plant residues are more short-lived and are sometimes lost when the excavators wash grinding tools to remove sediments. Longo's groups first began studying unwashed stone tools from Bilancino, a 28,000-year-old hunter-gatherer site in Italy. They found sandstone grinding implements that contained starch grains from cattail, which is a species of grass. Cattail and fern were also found on tools in southern Moravia in the Czech Republic and also in Russia. All of the residues at the Paleolithic sites have been from wild plants. Even so, they offered substantial nutrition and were so widely distributed across Europe as to provide a reliable food source. However, evidence of farming and the intentional cultivation of food is not found until the Neolithic. And this is what defines really the Paleolithic to Neolithic transition. Since humans cannot get complete nutrition from meat alone, some scientists feel the evidence for flour making may be even older than currently guessed at. Bruce Hardy, a paleoanthropologist from Kenyon College in Ohio, notes this is not isolated to a small group of people. It's a regular part of subsistence for humans, and adds that if you get that much meat in your diet, not balanced out with other nutrients, you'll actually get protein poisoning. Slightly baffled, actually, by this last article. It seems to completely fly in the face of everything we know really about humans and what they eat. I never really thought that we actually just entirely subsisted on meat, that of course we would have to eat other plant material. But anyway, it's nice to, the thing I actually am interested about is the fact that they are grinding up these to make a sort of floury paste. Anyway, I'll leave my opinions to myself. To Sweden now. Archaeologist Tony Eriksson of the Västergötland Museum has suggested a new interpretation of the Neolithic landscape at Falbygden area of Västergötland, an area of southwestern Sweden known for its concentration of megalithic graves dating from 4000 to 1500 BCE. Axelson used a geographic information system, GIS, to map the landscape of settlements, graves and other finds. Analysing these maps, he suggests that the passage graves were not intended to be highly visible monuments, but believes that the passage graves were built to take control of the landscape, to make it less dangerous, or as a conscious effort to tame it, and that as soon as a grave was built, the landscape seemed safer. I'm not exactly sure how graves make a land safe, but then that's opinions for you. His maps also suggest that human activity near the graves was limited, with few finds noted from such areas. This, he suggests, indicates that the settlements and passage graves were kept apart from one another. There was some sort of spatial separation for this. Axelson then argues that archaeologists need to characterise living landscapes using descriptive verbs and adjectives to reveal perceptions of landscape that have come from mental imagery and senses other than vision. Well, quite. We'll add that to our list of things to do, although I actually have no idea what he's talking about there. In Peru, are they geoglyphs or just agriculture? A huge network of geoglyphs representing birds, snakes and other animals is visible in satellite imagery of a large area around Titicaca Lake in Peru, a researcher is now claiming. Geoglyphs are works of art that were made from moving and arranging stones or earth in the landscape. Amelia Carolina, an assistant professor at the Department of Physics at Turin's Polytechnic University, using Google satellite maps and astrofrac tools, an astronomical image processing program which she herself had developed, investigated over 463 square miles of land around Peru's Titicaca Lake. She says that she's identified shapes that were built by Andean communities centuries ago. According to the researcher, enhanced satellite imagery revealed that some of the landforms were not only the remains of an extensive ancient agricultural system, but also those of formations designed to represent birds, snakes and other animals. Geometric lines and images of animals that are best viewed from the air, or geoglyphs, are best known in South America. Among the most famous geoglyphs are, of course, the Nazca lines on the southern coast of Peru and ring ditch sites in the Bolivian Amazon. Anthropologist Clark Eriksson of the University of Pennsylvania in the US notes that past Andean and Amazonian societies imposed order, structure and aesthetics on nature through intentional design, engineering activities of everyday life. They created a complex environment of fields, paths, roads, canals, shrines, ceremonial centres and settlements. These earthworks, of course, provide evidence of the impressive engineering abilities of the people who lived there in pre-Columbian times, built by excavating parallel canals and piling the earth to form long and low mounds. They raised fields, which were about 4 to 10 meters wide and 100 meters long, and up to a meter high, however, and other various measurements, of course. However, Eriksson questioned the interpretation of these geoglyph earthworks. He feels that the identification of particular symbols, such as birds, snakes, etc., is just not convincing. For example, what appears to be a bird wing in one image is a modern ploughed field with stacks of drying barley or wheat. But according to Sparvegina, Eriksson's observations only indicate that superimposed modern cultivation poses a threat to the geoglyphs. Fortunately for all parties concerned, the area might soon be declared a cultural heritage site in order to preserve all the ancient structures. Anyway, that's the end of the Archaeology News Week this week. But, exciting news, yes. Why not get yourself along to some absolutely massive changes at Past Horizons? That was at www.pasthorizons.com. Everything has had a massive revamp. You have all the same quality of articles and news, but it is just so good looking. You'll be amazed. So why not pop along to pastorhorizons.com to keep up with the latest news, to read some quality articles, have a look, watch some of the videos, and perhaps search for what you're going to be doing next year in volunteer archaeology around the world. Did I mention that there's a tool store there as well? I didn't. Well, I just have now. Anyway, can I remind you that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the UK Heritage Calendar, Library and Guidance section, can be found on Badger. That's www.bajr.org. And more can always be found at Stone Pages. news.stonepages.com. Thanks very much for listening to us. We hope you'll return again next week.